This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we consider some particular aspects of the legacy of former Justice Antonin Scalia.
Many commentators have noticed the homophobia of Justice Scalia's opinions, but what we highlight is his jurisprudence of death.
We'll listen to excerpts from a special event called An Evening of Solidarity, Parole for the Move 9. It's been over 30 years since law enforcement bombed and murdered many members of the Move family in Philadelphia. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Catherine Franke. I'm a law professor at Columbia Law School, and I chair the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Today, our listeners might hear a little background hum as Catherine and I discuss current events. We ask listeners to put up with this as a film company is outside taping. Catherine, a little over a week ago, the country was stunned to learn that Antonin Scalia, Supreme Court Associate Justice, passed away over the long weekend. And while pundits immediately started anticipating the political backlash that we'd have over whether Obama would appoint a new justice and what the fight would be over that, you have a somewhat different take on a lot of the discourse that I found quite fascinating.
Well, I'm in the academy, and a lot of us knew Justice Scalia. He, like the other justices, often made the rounds to law schools to give speeches, to preside over moot court. He did that frequently at Columbia and at other schools where I've taught. And many people, they're saying, well, I didn't really like his opinions, but he was a nice person. And a lot of Cass Sunstein and other important professors and jurists even are often making the case that maybe we ought to remember him for being a nice person rather than remembering him for his legacy on the court. And I would just note that he was appointed to the Supreme Court by President Reagan not to be our friend, but to interpret the Constitution and to apply the laws to all of us. So in a way, I can't say I care much whether Antonin Scalia was a nice person when he was not on the bench and when he was going to the opera with Justice Ginsburg. When writing for the court, he was often vindictive and gratuitously cruel, in my view, taking what seemed to many as schoolyard aim at LGBT people, women, people of color, criminal defendants, and poor people. His opinions were often snarky, especially when he was in the minority. And when he was writing a dissent, of course, he was often writing for himself, so he could write in his own voice, which was not true as often when he was writing for the majority. But the snarkiness of his opinions, I regarded as injudicious and often appalling.
Catherine, I read that former Justice Blackmun actually took issue at the emotional content of one of Scalia's 38-page drafts, saying it could be cut down to 10 pages if Scalia omitted the screaming.
Well, it was part of what made his opinions fun to read, and it's part of what made them extremely problematic. Justice Scalia was both a bad loser and a bad winner. And he was described by Margaret Talbot, a New Yorker writer, as the jurisprudential equivalent of smashing a guitar on stage. Now, that makes good theater, and it's fun to teach his opinions, I have to confess, and I do teach them because they are opinions from the court. But they really, to me, represent a betrayal of what the role of a Supreme Court justice is, which is to take the law seriously, but also to take us seriously. In his opinion, in his dissent in the same-sex marriage case, the Obergefell decision last year, he described the court, his colleagues, as a committee of nine, not as the Supreme Court, not as judges. He actually insulted the court itself. And to me, that is not the sign of a great jurist. It's the sign of somebody who in many ways has paved the path for the kind of politics we see coming from Donald Trump.
Now, speaking of that, I was interested in the fact that Scalia really seemed to want to convince his fellow jurists of his opinion. He issued weekly little memos. Is that appropriate? And was he a bully?
Well, wanting to convince your colleagues of your position, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what Supreme Court justices do. And that give and take among the justices is, I think, absolutely appropriate. The insult and the vitriol when they all didn't agree with him was what was problematic about it. The court splits all the time on the hardest issues of the day. And in theory, at least, they rise again to fight another battle the next day as colleagues. But he was particularly vicious with respect to Justice O'Connor in many of his opinions, where he singled out her opinions as imbecilic or stupid. There was a gendered bullying and a kind of excess of what I would call masculine vitriol that he directed particularly towards Justice O'Connor, but not only.
Catherine, some have remarked at how Justice Scalia has actually come down favorably in cases involving criminal defendants. For example, the right to confront your accuser, the Sixth Amendment protection. But he was especially hard in death penalty cases, and you had some insights into that.
Well, you know, when revisiting Justice Scalia's death penalty opinions or opinions in which he expressed views on the death penalty over the last few days, part of what I came away from is that he revels in a jurisprudence of death, what I might even call a necropolitics or a necrojurisprudence. Former law professor Robert Cover, who passed away far too young but was at Yale, and wrote a really remarkable article called Violence and the Word. And in that article, his first sentence is, "Legal interpretation takes place in a field of pain and death." And what he was saying there is that judges have the power to create worlds and to extinguish them with the stroke of a pen. And there's a way in which Justice Scalia reveled in that power to cause pain and to order death. So as a few examples, the 1993 Herrera versus Collins case was a death penalty case that involved the question of whether newly discovered evidence that would exonerate someone convicted of murder and sentenced to death could be used to overturn the death conviction, at least, the death sentence at least. And in his concurrence in this case, he wrote that mere factual innocence is no reason not to carry out a death sentence properly reached. So the fact that the procedural protections were in place for this defendant was all that mattered to him. The fact that he was factually innocent did not resonate with him whatsoever. He reiterated this view in his dissent to a death penalty appeal in 2009 involving Troy Davis, and he said, "This court has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who has had a full and fair trial, but is later able to convince a habeas court that he is actually innocent." And he puts "actually" in scare quotes. And what we see here, I think in a lot of Justice Scalia's writing, but particularly around the death penalty, is that gap between legality and justice. What the courts might have done was legal, but it didn't accomplish justice. And to execute innocent people is a horrible affront of justice, in my view.
Do you think there was a morality issue that infused some of his decisions in these cases?
Yes and no. At times he celebrated the fact that he was a strict constructionist, and he said the text of a statute, the text of the Constitution is all we are here to do or all we're here to interpret, and moral arguments are irrelevant. So particularly in thinking about abortion, thinking about reproductive rights more generally, thinking about gay rights, thinking about racial justice, you know, he said the word abortion doesn't appear in the Constitution. The word privacy doesn't appear in the Constitution. The framers weren't thinking about abortion. And so there is no constitutional right to abortion. This is a way in which his approach to interpretation sidelined questions of morality. Yet, in the Obergefell case and in many of the other gay rights cases before the court, he very strongly felt and agreed with a majority that he saw who thought homosexuality was an abomination and was the same thing as bestiality and murder. At one point, he equated homosexual sex acts or same-sex sex acts to murder, and that the people collectively are entitled to criminalize both murder and same-sex sex. And what this means is that the Constitution's liberty and equality provisions really stand for nothing. They're empty words, and they could apply equally to the context of racial justice, too.
How did he come down on the Second Amendment and gun control-related issues?
Well, in a horrible case, Heller versus the District of Columbia from 2008. I just taught this case last week, and so it's fresh in my mind. And it's a case in which there was a challenge to the District of Columbia gun control laws, which were quite strict, and they did a number of things from licensing requirements to who could carry guns. But specifically what they did, too, was that they required that guns at home be unloaded, that ammunition be stored separately from the weapon itself, and that the weapon be locked and rendered unusable without significant steps, like a trigger lock or disassembled, so that you'd have to put it back together again. And the idea here with this gun control law was to minimize the number of accidental gun deaths in the home. You know, kids shooting kids who think it's a toy gun and it's loaded.
A safety precaution.
Absolutely. And many people think this is a reasonable precaution. And most importantly, the people of the District of Columbia thought so. And Justice Scalia, writing for the court in this decision, said the Second Amendment's protection of the right to bear arms includes the right to use arms. And what he did in that little move from bear to use is overrule really centuries of self-defense law, which dictates that you, when attacked, have a duty first to retreat and allow the police or public officials to step in to protect you. And if that is not possible, then you have a right to defend yourself. But what this case says is that the Second Amendment protects the right for private people to use private violence, supplanting the police and supplanting public security measures, and ushered in what has become a period of enormous gun violence.
Right, and Seventh Circuit Judge Richard Posner disagreed with Scalia on this, saying that the Second Amendment, quote, creates no right to the private possessions of guns.
Or the private use of
or
guns,
the private
shooting
use.
Of guns.
And I think, from what I understand, Scalia had said that the court's originalists only needed to show that the Second Amendment, when it was ratified, at that time the right to bear arms was not exclusively limited to a military context, as you suggested. There was the right to defend. And he said they were successful in showing that.
Well, here you have Judge Posner. I'm sure he would love to be Justice Posner, as would many of my colleagues. But Judge Posner, who is also a conservative, arguing with Justice Scalia on the terms that Justice Scalia set, which is that we should look back to the original intent of the authors and ratifiers of the Second Amendment. Many of us would disagree with that method of interpretation, but even if you're going to undertake that way of looking at the meaning of the Constitution, Justice Scalia was an outlier in the way in which he read history and froze the Constitution in time. As he said, the Constitution that I interpret and apply is not living, but dead. And as a woman, as a lesbian, for people of color, for many people who were not certainly in the minds, their rights were not in the minds of the framers of the Constitution, that is a statement that the Constitution doesn't apply to you. Slavery was legal at the time that the Constitution was signed and ratified. Women were second-class citizens. People of color were less than second-class citizens. We didn't have the kind of complex, wired life that we have now. And to say that we don't live with a living constitution is to render it not only irrelevant, but to render it dangerous, I think. And we saw that in so many of Justice Scalia's opinions.
Catherine, will you be continuing to teach or discuss some of these issues in your class in the upcoming weeks?
Well, I'm not going to turn to Justice Scalia more especially than I would have anyway. But I, you know, like many academics, we do find his opinions fun to teach because they give us a way of thinking or teaching against an opinion. And they give his rhetoric is entertaining. But in the end, I always want to foreground with my students what the stakes are. And, you know, fun, clever, smart insults is not what I want to teach in my classes. In my view, the Constitution is a collective compact and a repository of shared values, not, as was often the case with Justice Scalia's opinions, a warrant for the privilege to maintain their power by reference to what the original framers intended.
Catherine, when Scalia came to speak at various law schools, what did you observe about him?
Well, there was much excitement when he would come to, say, judge our moot court competitions at law school, partly because he's just fun on the bench. He's very animated. He's often very spirited in his questioning. But in the end, one of the ways I would characterize Justice Scalia's manner, particularly with law students who were incredibly nervous speaking and arguing before him, is that he punched down. This is something that Peter Shane recently wrote. He's a professor at Ohio State Law School. He wrote a piece in the Washington Monthly about how Justice Scalia came to his law school and basically humiliated and insulted a young law student, a woman who was arguing in front of him, who was clearly very nervous. And his response to her is, "You clearly don't know anything about the law." And I saw this time and again, not only with our law students, but with faculty. You know, some of our faculty would get nervous in front of Justice Scalia, and you'd see it in the Supreme Court where lawyers would get up to argue. It may be their first time arguing before the court. It's an intimidating setting. And he took advantage of the power that he had. Rather than helping the argument improve itself by a friendly question or a comment that might help calm them down, he would, as Professor Shane said, punch down.
That reminds me, Catherine, just in general, of the Socratic method that I think many law schools are sort of modifying and maybe even doing away with, wouldn't you say?
Well, no, almost no one at Columbia uses the Socratic method anymore. We certainly call on students, and some of us call on them cold, as we say, with no warning. And largely we do that so that we make sure that everyone in the room has done the reading for each class, because you don't know if you're going to be called on. But we don't use calling on students and asking them questions as a way to humiliate them in the way that the paper chase sort of figured what law school looks like. That just is, it's been repudiated as good pedagogy. No one's learning, and very often people walk away feeling humiliated.
Would you say it's accurate that over his three decades on the bench, that methodology, in fact, became more common practice before the Supreme Court, interrupting the attorneys?
Well, you know, we have Justice Thomas, who's not asked a question in decades, and so there's a wide difference of practices among the justices of who's the most animated questioner, and what I think is almost more interesting is how they question each other, and they use their questions as a way to challenge one another and the positions that they anticipate the others will take. And Justice Scalia was certainly the leader of that sort of method of questioning at oral argument, where he would take jabs at his colleagues as much as he would punch down at the people arguing the cases in front of him.
And just a final question, Catherine, I'm curious because I haven't been in a classroom in a while, but among your students, do you find a trend of questioning the current composition of the court or being concerned at all about what's happening in what we see as a trend toward, you know, encroaching conservatism?
Well, this has been a conservative court for quite some time, but I would say my students as much as they are like anyone else, suspicious of the political context that surrounds the court and are cognizant of the fact that these are political appointments, my students want to believe in their hearts, most of them, that the rule of law means something and that the Constitution means something. They have a kind of faith in the law. And as much as I'm a critic of some of the Supreme Court's opinions, I do want to honor that. And I think it's important that we understand that judges do take seriously, for the most part, the idea that the law constrains what they can do and that they're not appointed to the bench merely to implement their own political goals or motives. There certainly is sufficient evidence to point in the other direction in some cases, but I, in my heart of hearts, still maintain some faith in the law. I wouldn't be teaching law if I didn't believe that.
May 13, 2015 marked 30 years since the bombing and murder by law enforcement of the Move family in Philadelphia. Seven remaining Move prisoners are still being denied parole after becoming eligible in 2008. Two of the original nine, Phil and Merle, died under suspicious circumstances with little information shared by officials. In early February, an evening of solidarity, parole for the Move 9, was held at the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Center in New York. It featured such speakers as Ramona Africa from Move, Johanna Fernandez of the campaign to bring Mumia home, and Amina Baraka, New Jersey activist, poet, and movement leader. Today we share with you excerpts from a few of these talks.
Moving right along here. Hey, bye, don't get restless. We got a couple more speakers. Then we got the hip-hop show coming up, too. Hip-hop for the Move 9. All right, our next speaker, where's the sister at? Live from Baruch College and the coordinator of the campaign to bring Mumia home. We give y'all Sister Johanna Fernandez. Put it together, y'all.
Also the author of several books and a documentary film called Justice on Trial. And we do have the book on the brothers' table over there called The Writings on the Wall.
They have the money, they have the organization, and if we're gonna free the Move 9, if we're gonna bring all our political prisoners home, and if we are gonna mount a revolution in this country, we need money and we need organization. I just want to say that NPR on May 20th, 2015 covered the Move organization and the Move bombing, and the question raised by NPR was, why have so many people never heard of the Move bombing? And I think that we who are here, the people of conscience who know this story, have a responsibility at this particular moment to answer that question and to make sure that everyone in this city, that everyone in Philadelphia, everyone in this country, and everyone around the world knows the Move bombing. The reason why we do not know about the Move bombing is because with the Move bombing and with the treatment of the Move organization, we see a human rights atrocity in this nation of epic proportion. We did, or the government of this nation did, to the Move people what we do to the Palestinians, what we did to the Iraqis, what we did to the Afghanis. We bombed them, we disregarded their life, we disregarded their humanity. In this nation, we only do that. The government only does that in such horrific a way to black people. To black people who dare to resist and stand against what this system represents. I want to start out, I'm going to be talking about Janet, Janine, and Debbie today, and I want to talk about Janet, Janine, and Deb, because we rarely about women political prisoners. I also think that as we read the story of the MOVE organization, because of all of the human rights atrocities behind them, we are empowered to fight. So I want to give you a sense of who these women are and why they joined the MOVE organization. Because if we're going to defend them, we need to know their stories, and we need to tell their stories from a mountaintop. This is what Janet Holloway, Africa, said about her politicization and why she joined the MOVE organization. A young woman, African-American, this is what she says. I can't even put into words the feeling I got hearing John Africa's teachings. It gripped me in a way that I've never, never been gripped before. For the first time in my life, I felt there was hope for me, and there was reasons why I was so detached, so dissatisfied, and so unhappy. What we know is that MOVE was persecuted and continues to be persecuted because of its fierce philosophical, political, and spiritual defense of life. That which the system of capitalism has absolutely no regard for. This system feared MOVE's defense of the water, an issue that is with us today and that we see in Flint, Michigan. And MOVE was talking about the water in the 1970s before talking about the water and the environment was trendy in American society. This system feared MOVE for its defense of the water, for its defense of the environment, for its defense of the earth, the food we eat, all issues that are very alive and well and part of public discourse today, which tells us that MOVE in the 1970s was ahead of its time. MOVE was feared because of its defense of the life source, which MOVE believes to be mama. This mama, MOVE's believes, is the purveyor of the life source, and for that, MOVE was attacked. MOVE in the 1970s, at the end of that age of great dreams, was a symbol of resistance and a terrible black threat to the status quo. It was a threat that in the imagination of authority had to be silenced. I want to talk a little bit about Janet Africa, because we need to know the stories of these powerful MOVE women. On May 9th, 1974, Janet and fellow MOVE sister Leasing Africa were walking to the store. They were accosted by cops who quickly became abusive against these women. Both Janet and Leasing were pregnant. The police slammed Janet stomach first against the police car. Both their children, the child of Janet and Leasing, were killed by the police through miscarriage. They both lost their children that night as a result of an encounter with the police through miscarriage. Now I want to talk about Janine Phillips Africa and about why she joined the MOVE organization. She said that at the age of 17, she was overwhelmed because she had a baby. And we know the experience of black poor women in this country with children. Janine was one of those young women at 17, and this is what she said, quote, "I didn't know how to be a mother or a wife, and trying to be both was driving me to a nervous breakdown. I developed a condition where my throat would close up on me, and I couldn't eat. I went from doctor to doctor, hospital to hospital, and none of them could do anything for me," unquote. She found love, refuge, righteous struggle, family, and collective childcare in the MOVE organization. and her condition, the fact that her throat had closed up and no one could tell her why, no doctor, was resolved because she found in MOVE community and an antidote to her alienation, a reason to struggle for Black people, for all people, and for freedom in these United States and in the world. As the repression against MOVE was mounting in the 1970s, 10 police cars descended on the MOVE house and attacked 7 MOVE members who had just been released from prison. Janine stepped in to defend her valiant husband, the late Phil Africa, who was recently killed by the state. The cops threw Janine to the ground, even though she was carrying her 3-week-old daughter, Life Africa. She was carrying Life Africa in her arms. Life Africa was killed that day by the police. Immediately, the MOVE organization held a press conference the next day. Officials denied the killing of Life Africa because Life was born in the MOVE house and didn't have a birth certificate. So the MOVE organization strategically did what it has been doing for the last 40 years. It invited local politicians to their house, the MOVE house, the sanctity of that house and the sanctity of Life, to view the body of Life Africa. And the media had to report on it. I want to now talk about Debbie Sims Africa. She tells a compelling story about the day the MOVE house was attacked and destroyed by the city of Philadelphia on August 18, 1978. And all of these atrocities are happening before the actual bombing of the MOVE house in 1985. This is what she says about that day that the MOVE house was under siege by the city of Philadelphia. She was in the house with her 23-month-old, and she was 8.5 weeks pregnant with Mike Africa, who's with us today. The pressure, she says, of the fire hoses used by the firemen to drown out the house was so fierce, I'm quoting her now, that it threw the 2x4 oak beams of the window across the room, slamming our big dogs up against the wall and literally tearing the house apart from the inside. Then a second wave of water came through another would-be window, and we were caught in a crossfire of water. When the cops started shooting, I closed my eyes and just held tight to my stomach and protectively shielded my baby. The smoke bombs and tear gas were choking us. All the while, the water level was rising. We found out later during our trial from one of the lawyers appointed to represent us that when a mixture of smoke and water are thrown together, it acts as a deadly weapon and could have suffocated all of us. I personally thought we were going to die. It was only a miracle that we didn't die. Within a year or so, she had Mike Africa in prison, naturally on her own, alone in prison. She held Mike Africa for 7 hours and then faced the inevitable that Mike, her son, would have to be taken from her. And this is what happens to women and Black women disproportionately in this nation, day in and day out, in a nation where the incarceration of Black women is growing at 800%. That behind MOVE, there's a long history of repression against radicals and revolutionaries, but there's also a long history of survival, challenge to the system, and victory. Behind the MOVE organization, we see Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, John Brown, Eugene Debs, the Haymarket Martyrs, Sacco and Vanzetti, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, Angela Davis, Mike Africa, David Gilbert, Sekou Odinga, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Luis Rodriguez, Leonard Peltier, Sundiata Okoli, Phil Africa, Abdul Majid, Mumia Abu-Jamal, did I mention Oscar Lopez, Bradley Manning? These are political prisoners, people who are responsible for civilizing American society. All of this tells us that we really stand on the shoulders of giants, and our responsibility, the moral assignment of our generation, is to bring our brothers and sisters home. And when Mumia comes home, the Move 9 will come home, and the whole apparatus of this system, its very logic, will come tumbling down. Free the Move 9, free the Move Women, and onward to a completely different society.
That was Johanna Fernandez of the campaign to bring Mumia home, speaking at the event, An Evening of Solidarity, Parole for the Move 9. We hear now from Lynn Stewart, who also spoke at the event for the Move 9.
I'm going to bring this dynamic trio up, and is Lynn Stewart, Ralph, and Betty Davis. When Lynn was in jail, I'm telling you, the fight to bring Lynn home... The fight to bring Lynn home was a battle that you'll never, ever forget. So the two warriors behind the battle, and here she is. Revolution do work. Consistency. Isn't that what we're talking about? That's right.
So I don't want to take more time. We have some more wonderful, wonderful speakers who will talk to you. I am going to read you a poem because you know that's my thing. I love poetry. It's what kept me alive and sustained me, along with a couple of other folks while I was in prison. A couple of other folks, all of whom are sitting in the audience as well. But I'm going to read you a poem by a newfound friend who I really didn't know much about until a couple of years ago. Mongo Netuilango, and he's a great poet, and he's been 45 years in jail in Nebraska. So you know he's not getting a whole lot of visits. He's an ex-Panther. There is going to be a parole hearing in November. This year is full of parole hearings. You know, write a form letter if you have to, but get letters out for these folks, for heaven's sakes. Lennox Hines is coming out of retirement to represent him. So let's do it. Let's get these letters out. Let's show that there is a group out here that the government has to be more afraid of than they are of the groups that want to keep them in. More afraid of us than of them. So I'm going to read you a poem. I'm going to read just part of it. It's kind of long. And it's really about who is the real enemy, and not to be led astray by not false enemies, but with... It has to do with the fight against the Confederate flag. And it talks about what flag we should really fight against. To have more dirt kicked in our faces in the twilight's endless gleaming of shattered hopes, which in truth this flag of Bill Clinton and Strom Thurmond represents, this old glory in the here and now, where it is not Confederate flags sewn on the shirts of the cops who commit their brutalities on the streets of America, not Confederate flags flying in front of the courts that dispense to us injustice with such consistent regularity. Not Confederate flags in the classrooms of the schools committing the menticide of our children. Not Confederate flags on the grounds of banks with us and them lending policies by which we are them who systematically can't get what others can. Not Confederate flags flapping from the poles of corporate headquarters where CEOs decide that the communities where we live are options for toxic waste dumps, chemical refineries, Flint. Not in the shadow of the Confederate flag did the hearses cruise and the cruisers creep, their sirens like hyenas' howls, their drivers on the prowl to catch the crimes in progress of driving while black walking while black, just chilling while black, fitting the general description of, to catch the optical illusions of wallets that look like guns. Not in the shadow of the Confederate flag do these and other kinds and shapes of murder run and deceptions big and small, but in the shadow of the stars and stripes that we sing an anthem and pledge allegiance. Justice for all included us. Remember the enemy. Let's get out there. Let's keep our fight up. We can do it. We are many. They are few. Thank you.
That was Lynn Stewart speaking at an evening of solidarity, Parole for the Move 9. We hear now from Amina Baraka, New Jersey activist, movement leader, and poet.
Damn, this is pleasurable. And I hope everybody's writing the information down. If you don't, everybody have information at their tables. But I'm getting ready to introduce a sister, warrior, word assassin, the wife of Amiri Baraka. Yes, yes, and I'm telling you, she is a word assassin. She is poetry in motion. She's a grandmother. She's a mother. I'm saying she's a widow at this time, but she's a warrior woman of all things, a noted one, an unapologetic one. She will lay your ass out no matter where you are when you're wrong. She ain't got no problem with it. She can lay it out in poetry. She can lay it out any kind of way there is. The unapologetic warrior with class.
This is embarrassing. I'm standing before people who have given their lives and their children's life. This is embarrassing. No, when I say that, and I'm serious about that, is that everybody in this audience have given much more than I will ever be able to give. Or my husband, who has gone. But you have given your lives and your children's lives, and our people are still in prison. And we've got to do something. And I love what everybody has said. The people united will never be defeated. Black, Latin, Asian, white, and get it right. And as a poem, it's time to free the Move 9. I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to feel low down. I got a right to hang down by the river. Cause the river flows. Cause this old racist imperialist state keeps trying to bring the whole world down. Yeah, I got a right. I got a right to sing the blues. I wanna write blues lines about workers dying of black lung, brown lung, overworked, underpaid, blown up, burnt fingers cut off, and wretched lives in general. I got a right to sing the blues. I wanna sing songs that weep the pain and horror of monopoly capitalism. Words that paint imperialism as the world's enemy, cause it is. I got a right. I wanna
want to write blues lines about workers that led the strike, the ones that spoke out, the ones that demonstrated against the death penalty. I got a right to sing the blues. The ones that fight racism and anti-Semitism. The ones for Palestinian liberation. The ones that seek peace in the Middle East. Oh, I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to feel low down. I want to pass out leaflets. This is for the people who pass out leaflets to free the Caribbean, Latin America, and protect Cuba.
That's right.
I got a right to sing the blues. The workers that support the Irish, Asian, African revolutions, the ones that lead the peace movement, the ones that stand up for working class women, gay rights, and religious freedom. Oh, I got a right to sing the blues, and I'm gonna sing them.
All right, come on.
I wanna celebrate all of them in a lyrical way, in a way they will like. Yeah, I wanna be a people's poet. I wanna write fire lines. I wanna sing the blues that free us all, that will catch on to the bourgeoisie's hoods, burn the cover off their lies, expose them as the first and real criminals. I want to write words that will do some good, that will unite the international working class, something that will do good for black people and all people and everybody and everyone that is oppressed. Oh, I want to sing the blues. I want to be a poet of the people. Use my words to accompany the struggle against imperialism. Because that's the only way I can be a people's poet and do some real good. Because I know how to sing the blues. And I'm gonna sing the blues until everybody in prison who ain't supposed to be there get out and get free. And this goes to all of y'all. It's time to free the Move Night. And I'm gonna sing the blues. Thank you.
That was Amina Baraka, poet, New Jersey activist, and movement leader, speaking at an evening of solidarity, parole for the Move Nine.
He is always there for us. We have been up to CEMOTAP, most programs that they have. We've been to the...
Free all our political prisoners. Free them all. I'm here on behalf, and first let me thank all of the organizers for tonight's event. Let me thank the Minister of Confrontation, Sister Pam Africa, for inviting me in that introduction. And I'm just here to say that CEMOTAP, the Committee to Eliminate Media Offensive to African People, is 100% in solidarity with the call and the demand to free our political prisoners. And we don't have the military power to bust them out and keep them out. We'll settle for parole. You don't have to be a revolutionary to be for parole for the Move Nine. You don't have to be a revolutionary. I mean, it sickens my stomach to think of the Move Nine having to report to a parole officer. It sickens my stomach for me to think of them having to say they will abide by the corrupt laws of this corrupt government, whatever else they have to do to be on parole. but not as much as it sickens my stomach to think of them in those dangerous, nasty dungeons that they've been in for the last 38 years. Not as much as it sickens me to think about them staying in there for 20 or more years. Not as much as it sickens me to think of them perhaps even dying behind those walls. No, I take parole every day of the week for the Move 9 and for all our political prisoners rather than that. Parole is nothing revolutionary. There's people who are not fit to kiss the feet of the Move 9 that have been given parole. Some of them don't even have to get parole. Justin Volpe. You ever heard that name? That's the man who tortured Abner Louima. They gave him a sentence of 30 years with no parole. That's a trick, because that means in 30 years they got to let him out. You see? He's already gotten married down there in Florida, and not to that little knucklehead that was talking about the black woman that said she was his girlfriend. Not, she went down there to Florida. He married a white woman, okay? Justin Volpe, all right? They're letting him out in 9 years. He's going to be walking out of here on the street, having served 8 years less than the Move 9 has already served. There's a woman, Sarah Moore. She busted 2 cats at the President of the United States. 2. Shot twice. Hit an innocent bystander. Got to court. They asked her, "Are you sorry?" These are almost her exact words. She said, "I regret I didn't succeed." She said, "Our purpose was to create chaos." In 1987 or so, not 1997, a couple of years after that, she escaped. Guess what happened? In about 32 years, she got parole. The Move 9 been down 38 years. This guy, Messer, shot Oscar Grant. He served less time than Michael Vick served for killing a dog. Less than 2 years. Squeaky Frome. President Ford. Got to court, took an apple, threw it and hit the DA in the face, knocked his glasses off. In 1987, she escaped for 2 days. 22 years after that escape, they let out on parole. This is nothing revolutionary. This is something that's supposed to happen to you when you get corrected. The Move 9 didn't need any correcting. They were eating right. They were exercising. They were having their babies. They were preaching life. They were confronting injustice. They didn't need any correcting. But certainly, 38 years, they got to be correct if Squeaky Frome is correct in 22 after trying to escape. So my point is that CMOTAP, the Committee to Eliminate Media Offensive to African People, yes, is down with this tactical decision to call for parole. We're here to do whatever it is that you need us to do to call for parole, because this is nothing revolutionary. Now you might say, why did they send me? I'm only speaking on behalf of my organization, CMOTAP. Why did they send me in this suit? A black suit. I'm going to tell you why. There's a reason. This is not an accident. They sent me here to show the strength of our coalition. Not only do we have masked up revolutionaries, dreadlock revolutionaries, dashiki wearing revolutionaries, we got respectable, suited, and tied up Negroes like myself with all the bourgeois credentials. A job, a MD degree, a haircut. So listen, ain't nothing to be scared of. Everybody joining on this movement. We want freedom for the Move 9. We want parole for the Move 9. Free them all! Free them all! Free them all! Thank you.
Woo! The man in the suit. Wow. Okay.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. We'll be right back.